utterly overpowering in person, it was understandable how he had won the role of the Sheen actor. I was happy to buy him a drink to show that I was not bothered by his advances, and he in turn bought me another, and we bonded that night, and almost every night that followed. As Yoon had tried with me, I had tried with Asia Su, the actress. Like me, she was of mixed race descent, although of a much more refined pedigree. In her case, a British fashion designer mother and a Chinese hotelier father. Her given name really was Asia, her parents foreseeing that any progeny of their unlikely union would surely be blessed with sufficient attributes to live up to the name of an entire ill-defined continent. She had three unfair advantages over any man on the set, with the exception of James Yoon. She was in her early 20s, was a high-end fashion model, and was a lesbian. Every man on the set, myself included, was convinced that he possessed the magic wand that would convert her back to heterosexuality. If that was not achievable, then he would settle for convincing her that he was the kind of liberated man so open to female homosexuality, he would not be offended, not at all, in watching her have sex with another woman. Some of us confidently declared that all high-end fashion models did was have sex with each other. If we were high-end fashion models, so the reasoning went, with whom would we rather have sex, men like us or women like them? Such a question was a little deflating to the masculine ego, and it was with some trepidation that I had approached her at the hotel pool. "Hi," I said. Perhaps it was my body language or something in my eyes, for before I could go any further, she laid down her copy of Jonathan Livingston Seagull and said, "You're lovely, but just not my type. It's not your fault. You're a man." Yet again flabbergasted, all I could say was, "You can't blame a guy for trying." And she did not, so we too were friends. These, then, were the major dramatis personae of the Hamlet, all recorded in the letter I sent to my aunt, along with glazed Polaroids of myself and the cast, even one with the reluctant auteur. Also included were Polaroids of the refugee camp and its denizens, as well as newspaper clippings that the general had provided me before my departure. Drowning, pillage, rape, cannibalism, so went the headlines. The general had read them to me with alternating and escalating notes of horror and triumph, about how refugees were reporting that only one in two boats was surviving the crossing from the beaches and inlets of our homeland to the nearest semi-friendly shores in Hong Kong, Indonesia, Malaysia, and the Philippines, storms and pirates sinking the rest. "Here it is," the general said, shaking a newspaper at me, "the evidence that those communist bastards are purging the country." To Man's aunt, I wrote visibly in my letter about how sad it was to see these stories. Invisibly, I wrote, "Is this really happening, or propaganda?" "As for you, Commandant, what dream do you think compelled these refugees to escape, taking to the sea in leaky little boats that would have terrified Christopher Columbus? If our revolution served the people, why were some of these people voting by fleeing?" At the time, I had no answers to these questions. Only now am I beginning to understand. Things on set went along smoothly until Christmas, by which time the weather had cooled down considerably, although it still felt like a constant warm shower, according to the Americans. Most of the scenes shot before December were of the non-combat variety. Sergeant Bellamy arrives in Vietnam and promptly gets his camera ripped out of his hand by a motorbike-riding cowboy, a scene shot in the nearby town whose square had been remade in the likeness of downtown Saigon, complete with Renault taxis, authentic Vietnamese-lettered billboards, and haggling sidewalk vendors. Captain Seamus is called to headquarters in the same town, where a general verbally flogs him for blowing the whistle on a corrupt Arvin colonel, then punishes him by dispatching him to command the hamlet. Bucolic scenes of rural life with peasants planting rice stalks in paddies, while hard-working green berets oversee the construction of hamlet fortifications. A disgruntled green beret scrawling, "I believe in God, but God believes in napalm," on his helmet. Captain Seamus giving a motivational speech to the village militia, with their rusty bolt-action rifles and shuffling sandaled feet. Sergeant Bellamy, leading the same militia in battle drills involving marksmanship, crawling under barbed wire, preparing L-shaped night ambushes, and the first skirmishes between the invisible King Kong and the hamlet's defenders, which mostly involved the militia, firing their one mortar into the darkness. My movie-making days were consumed by ensuring that the extras knew where the wardrobe department was and when to shuffle to their scenes, that their dietary needs were met, that they were paid on a weekly basis their dollar a day, and that the roles for which they were needed were filled. The majority of the roles fell under the category of civilian, i.e., possibly innocent but also possibly Viet Cong, and therefore possibly going to be killed for either being innocent or being Viet Cong. Most of the extras were already familiar with this role, and therefore needed no motivation from me to get into the right psychology for possibly being blown up, dismembered, or just plain shot. The next largest category was the soldier of the Army of the Republic of Vietnam, i.e., the freedom fighter. All the male extras wanted to play this role, even though from the point of view of the American soldiers, this was the category of possibly friend but also possibly enemy, and therefore possibly going to be killed for being either a friend or an enemy. With a good number of Arvin veterans among the extras, I had no problem casting this role. The most troublesome category was the National Liberation Front guerrilla, pejoratively known as the Viet Cong, i.e., possibly freedom-loving nationalists, but also possibly hateful red communists, but really who cares, so kill him, or her, anyway. Nobody wanted to be the Viet Cong, i.e. the freedom fighters, even though it meant only playing one. The freedom fighters among the refugees despised these other freedom fighters with an unsettling, if not unsurprising, vehemence. As always, money solved the problem. After some strong persuasion on my part, Violet agreed to double the wages for those extras playing Viet Cong, an incentive that allowed these freedom fighters to forget that playing those other freedom fighters had once been so repugnant an idea. Part of what they found repugnant was that some of them would be called on to torture Bin and rape Mai. My relationship with the auteur began to unravel around the question of Mai's rape, although he was already irritated with me for speaking up on behalf of the extras in regard to the salary. Undeterred, I sat down at his lunch table the day before the filming of her rape scene and asked him whether a rape was really necessary. "It just seems a little heavy-handed," I said. "A little shock treatment never hurt an audience," he said, pointing at me with his fork. "Sometimes they need a kick in the ass so they can feel something after sitting down for so long. A slap on both cheeks, and I don't mean the ones on their faces. This is war, and rape happens. I have an obligation to show that, although a sellout like you obviously would disagree." The unprovoked attack stunned me, sellout vibrating in my mind with the electrical colors of a Warhol painting. "I am not a sellout," I finally managed to say. He snorted. "Isn't a sellout what your people would call someone who helps a white man like me? Or is loser a better term?" On this latter point, I could not disagree. The man who I presented myself as did belong to the losing side, and pointing out that the American side had lost too would not help matters any. "All right, a loser is what I am," I said. "I'm a loser for believing in all the promises your America made to people like me. You came and said we were friends, but what we didn't know was that you could never trust us, much less respect us. Only losers like us couldn't have seen what's so obvious now, how you wouldn't want anyone for your friend who actually wanted to be your friend. Deep down, you suspect only fools and traitors would believe your promises." It was not that he let me speak uninterrupted. That was not his style. "Oh, that's rich," he said soon after I began. "A moral runt sucks at my tits. A know-it-all who doesn't know anything, an idiot savant minus the savant. You know who else has an opinion about everything that no one pays any attention to? My senile grandmother. You think that because you went to college, people should listen to what you say? Too bad you've got a Bachelor of Science in bullshit." Perhaps I went too far when I invited him to perform fellatio on me, but he also went too far in threatening to kill me. "He's always saying he's going to kill somebody," Violet said after I informed her of what happened. "It's just a figure of speech. Promising to gouge out my eyes with a spoon and force-feeding me with them hardly sounded figurative, any more than the depiction of Mai's rape was simply figurative. No, the rape was a brutal act of the imagination, at least as evidenced by the script. As for the actual shooting of the scene, only the auteur, a handful of select crew, the four rapists, and Asia Su herself were present. I would have to wait for a year to see the scene myself, at a raucous movie theater in Bangkok. But I was an eyewitness to James Yoon's master scene 2 weeks later, for which he was stripped naked from the waist up and strapped to a plank. The plank was propped on the body of an extra playing a dead militiaman, leaving the somewhat anxious-looking James Yoon to lie with his head angled toward the earth, brace for the water cure that he was about to receive from the same four Viet Cong who had raped Mai. Standing by James Yoon, the auteur addressed the extras through me, although he never once looked at me, the two of us no longer on speaking terms. "At this point in the script, you've just made first contact with your enemy," he said to the rapist. The auteur had picked them because of the particular ferocity they had displayed in various scenes, as well as their distinctive physical features, the rotten banana brownness of their skin and the reptilian slits of their eyes. "You ambush a patrol, and this is the sole survivor. He's an imperialist puppet, a lackey, a stooge, a traitor. There's nothing worse in your eyes than someone who sells out his country for some rice and a couple of dollars. As for you, your legendary battalion's been cut in half. Hundreds of your brothers are dead, and hundreds more will die in the battle to come. You're intent on sacrificing yourself for the fatherland, but you're naturally fearful. Now comes this sniveling son of a bitch, this backstabber with yellow skin but a white soul. You hate this bastard. You're going to make him confess all his reactionary sins, then make him pay for them. But most of all, remember this. Have fun, be yourselves, and just act natural." These instructions caused some confusion among the extras. The tallest one and the ranking non-commissioned officer, a sergeant, said, "He wants us to torture this guy and look like we're enjoying ourselves, right?" The shortest extra said, "But what's that got to do with acting natural?" The tall sergeant said, "He tells us that every time." "But it's not natural to act like a VC," Shorty said. "What's wrong?" the auteur said. "Yes, what's wrong?" James Yoon said. "Nothing wrong," the tall sergeant said. "We okay, we number one." Then he switched back to Vietnamese and told the others, "Look, who cares what he says? He wants us to act natural, but we got to act unnatural. We are motherfucking VC. Got it?" They certainly did. Here was method acting at its finest. Four resentful refugees and former freedom fighters imagining the hateful psychology of the freedom fighters on the other side. With no more prodding from the auteur once the film started rolling, this gang of four began to howl, slither, and slather over the object of their hatred. At this point in the script, James Yoon's character of Bin, a.k.a. Benny, had been caught on a probe led by the A-Team's only black soldier, Sergeant Pete Attux. As established in an early anecdote, Attux traced his genealogy 2 centuries back to Crispus Attux, martyred by the British Redcoats in Boston, and the first famous black man to sacrifice his life for the cause of white people. Once Attuck's genealogy had been explained, his fate was sealed with superglue. In due time, he stepped into a booby trap, a bear claw clamp made of bamboo spikes that seized his left foot. While the rest of the Popular Forces squad was handily exterminated, he and Bin fired back until Attuck lost consciousness and Bin ran out of ammunition. When the Viet Cong captured them, they committed one of their infamous, heinous acts of desecration on Attuck, castrating him and stuffing his manhood into his mouth. This, according to Claude in his interrogation course, was something certain Native American tribes also inflicted on trespassing white settlers. Despite being of a different race, thousands of miles away and more than a century past. "See?" Claude said, showing us the slide of an archaic black-and-white illustration depicting such an indigenous massacre. He followed this with another slide, a black-and-white photograph featuring the similarly mutilated corpse of a GI captured by the Viet Cong. "Who says we don't share a common humanity?" Claude said, advancing to the next slide of an American GI urinating on a Viet Cong corpse. Bin's fate now rested in the hands of these Viet Cong, who reserved their scarce water not for bathing but for torture, while James Yoon, or his stunt double in another set of shots, was strapped to the plank, a dirty cloth wrapped around his head. One of the VC then slowly poured water from a foot above Bin's head onto the cloth, using Attuk's own canteens. Fortunately for James Yoon, the water torture only occurred in the shots involving a stuntman. Under the rag, the stuntman had his nostrils sealed and a tube for breathing in his mouth, since one cannot, of course, breathe under the cascade. The sensation suffered by the victim was close to drowning, or so I have been told by prisoners who have survived being put to the question, as the Spanish inquisitors described the infliction of the water cure. Again and again the question was asked of James Yoon, and while the water was surging onto his face, the VC clustered around, cursing, kicking, and punching him. All in simulation, of course. Such thrashing, such gurgling, such heaving of the breast and belly. After a while, out under a tropical sun as sultry as Sophia Loren, it was not just James Yoon, but even the extras who started to sweat from their efforts. This was what few people realize. It's hard work to beat somebody. I have known many an interrogator who has strained a back, pulled a muscle, torn a tendon or a ligament, even broken fingers, toes, hands, and feet, not to mention going hoarse. For while the prisoner is screaming, crying, and choking and confessing, or attempting to confess, or simply lying, the interrogator must produce a steady stream of epithets, insults, grunts, demands, and provocations with all the concentration and creativity of a woman manning a dirty talk sex line. It takes significant mental energy to be non-repetitive in heaping verbal abuse, and here, at least, the extras faltered in their performance. Blame should not be directed at them. They were not professionals. And the script merely said, VC interrogators curse and berate Bin in their own language. Left to improvise, the extras proceeded to give a repetitive lesson in gutter Vietnamese no one on set would ever forget. Indeed, while most of the crew never learned how to say thank you or please in Vietnamese, by the end of the shoot, everyone knew how to say fuck your mother or motherfucker, depending on how one translates Duma. I never cared much for the obscenity myself, but I could not help admiring how the extra squeezed every ounce of juice from the lime of it, spitting it out as a noun, verb, adjective, adverb, and exclamation, lending it intonations of not only hate and anger, but even, at some point, sympathy. Duma, Duma, Duma. Then, after the beating, cursing, and application of the water cure, the wet cloth would be unwrapped from Bin's face to reveal James Yoon, who knew this was his best chance for a supporting actor Oscar. He had been disposed of many times before on screen as the evanescent Oriental, but none of those deaths possessed this agony, this nobility. Let's see. He had told me one night at our hotel's bar, "I've been beaten to death with brass knuckles by Robert Mitchum, knifed in the back by Ernest Borgnine, shot in the head by Frank Sinatra, strangled by James Coburn, hanged by a character actor you don't know, thrown off a skyscraper by another, pushed out of the window of a Zeppelin, and stuffed in a bag of laundry and dropped in the Hudson River by a gang of Chinese guys. Oh yes, I was also disemboweled by a squad of Japanese. But all of those were quick deaths. All I ever got was a few seconds of screen time at most, and sometimes barely that. This time, though, and here he trotted out the giddy smile of a freshly crowned beauty pageant queen, it's going to take forever to kill me. So, whenever that cloth was unwrapped, and it was unwrapped many a time during the interrogation session, James Yoon gorged on the scenery with the starved fervor of a man who knew he was not going to be upstaged for once by the perennially cute and unbeatable little boy whose mother would not allow him to watch this scene. He grimaced, he groaned, he grunted, he cried, he wept, he bawled, all with real tears hauled up by the buckets from some well deep inside his body. After this, he yelled, he screamed, he shrieked, he wriggled, he twisted, he contorted, he thrashed, and he heaved, the climax being when he vomited, a chunky, regurgitated soup of his salty, vinegary breakfast of chorizo and eggs. At the conclusion of this extended first take, there was only cathedral silence on the part of the crew, stunned as they regarded what was left of James Yoon, as sacrificed and beaten as an uppity slave on an American plantation. The auteur himself came with a wet towel, knelt by the still-strapped-down actor, and tenderly wiped the vomit from James Yoon's face. That was amazing to me, absolutely amazing. "Thank you," James Yoon gasped. "Now let's try it one more time, just to be sure." In fact, 6 more takes were required before the auteur declared himself satisfied. At noon after the 3rd take, the auteur had asked James Yoon if he wanted to break for lunch, but the actor had shuddered and whispered, "No, don't unstrap me. I'm being tortured, aren't I?" While the rest of the cast and crew retired to the somnolent shade of the canteen, I sat by James Yoon and offered to shelter him with a parasol. But he shook his head with tortoise determination. "No, damn it, I'm seeing this through. It's only an hour in the sun. People like Bidden went through worse, didn't they?" "Much worse," I agreed. James Yoon's harrowing experience would at least be finished today, or so he hoped, whereas a real prisoner's mortification continued for days, weeks, months, years. This was true of those captured by my communist comrades, according to our intelligence reports, but it was also true of those interrogated by my colleagues in the special branch. Did the special branch interrogations take so long because the policemen were being thorough, unimaginative, or sadistic? "All of the above," said Claude, "and yet the lack of imagination and the sadism contradict the thoroughness." He was lecturing to a classroom of these secret policemen in the National Interrogation Center, the unblinking eyes of the windows looking out onto the Saigon dockyards. The 20 pupils of his subterranean specialty, including myself, were all veterans of the army or police, but we were still intimidated by his authority, the way he held forth with the pedigree of a professor at the Sorbonne, or Harvard, or Cambridge. "Brute force is not the answer, gentlemen, if the question is how to extract information and cooperation. Brute force will get you bad answers, lies, misdirection, or, worse yet, will get you the answer the prisoner thinks you want to hear. He will say anything to stop the pain. All of this stuff..." Here Claude waved his hand at the tools of the trade assembled on his desk, much of it made in France, including a billy club, a plastic gasoline container repurposed for soapy water, pliers, a hand-cranked electrical generator for a field telephone. "All of it is useless. Interrogation is not punishment. Interrogation is a science." Myself and the other secret policemen dutifully wrote this down in our notebooks. Claude was our American advisor, and we expected state-of-the-art knowledge from him and all the other American advisors. We were not disappointed. "Interrogation is about the mind first, the body second," he said. "You don't even have to leave a bruise or a mark on the body. Sounds counterintuitive, doesn't it? But it's true. We've spent millions to prove it in the lab. The principles are basic, but the application can be creative and tailored to the individual or to the imagination of the interrogator. Disorientation, sensory deprivation, self-punishment. These principles have been scientifically demonstrated by the best scientists in the world, American scientists. We have shown that the human mind, subject to the right conditions, will break down faster than the human body. All this stuff," again he waved his hand in contempt at what we now saw as Gaelic junk, "the tools of old-world barbarians rather than new-world scientists, of medieval torture rather than modern interrogation. It will take months to wear the subject down with these things. But put a sack on the subject's head, wrap his hands in balls of gauze, plug his ears, and drop him in a completely dark cell by himself for a week, and you no longer have a human being capable of resistance. You have a puddle of water." "Water, water," James Yoon said. "Can I get some water, please?" I fetched him some water. Despite the water cure, he had not actually had any water except what was absorbed through the wet cloth, which was just wet enough, he said, to be suffocating. As his arms were still bound, I slowly trickled the water down his throat. "Thanks," he muttered, just as any prisoner would be grateful to his torturer for the drop of water or the morsel of food or the minute of sleep that the torturer doled out. For once I was relieved to hear the auteur's voice calling out, "All right, let's get this done so Jimmy can get back to the pool." By the final take 2 hours later, James Yoon really was lachrymose with pain, his face bathed in sweat, mucus, vomit, and tears. It was a sight that I had seen before, the communist agent. But that was real, so real I had to stop thinking about her face. I focused on the fictional state of total degradation that the auteur wanted for the next scene, which itself required several takes. In this scene, the last one of the movie for James Yoon, the Viet Cong, frustrated because of their inability to break their victim and get him to confess to his crimes, beat his brains out with a spade. Being a bit exhausted from torturing their victim, however, the quartet first decide to take a break, smoking Pete Attuck's Marlboros. Unfortunately for them, they underestimated the will of this bin, who, like many of his southern brethren, whether they be freedom fighters or freedom fighters, was as laid back as a California surfer regarding every matter except the question of independence from tyranny. Left alone without the towel around his neck, he was free to bite off his own tongue and drown under a faucet of his own fake blood, a commercial product that cost $35 a gallon, and of which approximately 2 gallons were used to paint James Yoon and decorate the earth. When it came to Bin's brains, though, Harry had concocted his own homemade cerebral matter, a secret recipe of oatmeal mixed with agar, the result being a gray, clumpy, congealed mess that he lovingly daubed on the earth around James Yoon's head. The cinematographer got especially close to capture the look in Bin's eyes, which I could not see from where I was watching, but which I assumed to be some saintly mix of ecstatic pain and painful ecstasy. Despite all the punishment inscribed on him, he had never uttered a word, at least not an intelligible one. Chapter 11. The longer I worked on the movie, the more I was convinced that I was not only a technical consultant on an artistic project, but an infiltrator into a work of propaganda. A man such as the auteur would have denied it, seeing his movie purely as art. But who was fooling whom? Movies were America's way of softening up the rest of the world. Hollywood relentlessly assaulting the mental defenses of audiences with the hit, the smash, the spectacle, the blockbuster, and, yes, even the box office bomb. It mattered not what story these audiences watched. The point was that it was the American story they watched and loved, up until the day that they themselves might be bombed by the planes they had seen in American movies. Man, not surprisingly, understood Hollywood's function as the launcher of the intercontinental ballistic missile of Americanization. I had written him a worried letter about the relevance of my work on the movie, and he had written back his most detailed messages ever. First, he addressed my concerns about the refugees. Conditions here exaggerated there. Remember our party's principles. Enemies of the party must be rooted out. His second message concerned my fear of being a collaborator with the auteur. Remember Mao at Yan'an. That was all. But it dispelled the black crow of doubt sitting on my shoulder. When was the last time an American president found it worth his while to write a speech on the importance of art and literature? I cannot recall. And yet, at Yan'an, Mao said that art and literature were crucial to revolution. Conversely, he warned, art and literature could also be tools of domination. Art could not be separated from politics, and politics needed art in order to reach the people where they lived, through entertaining them. By urging me to remember Mao, Mann was telling me that my mission with this movie was important. Perhaps the movie itself was not terribly important, but what it represented, the genesis of the American movie, was. An audience member might love or hate this movie, or dismiss it as only a story, but those emotions were irrelevant. What mattered was that the audience member, having paid for the ticket, was willing to let American ideas and values seep into the vulnerable tissue of his brain and the absorbent soil of his heart. When Mann first discussed such issues with me, In our study group, I was dazed by his brilliance as well as Mao's. I was a lycée student who had never read Mao, never thought that art and literature had any relationship to politics. Man imparted that lesson by leading myself and the third member of our cell, a bespectacled youth named Wu, in a spirited discussion of Mao's lecture. The great helmsman's argument about art thrilled us. Art could be both popular, aimed for the masses, and yet advanced, raising its own aesthetic standard as well as the taste of the masses. We discussed how this could be done in Wu's garden with blustery teenage self-confidence, interrupted every now and again when Wu's mother served us a snack. Poor Wu eventually died in a provincial interrogation center, arrested for possession of anti-government pamphlets. But back then, he was a boy passionately in love with the poetry of Baudelaire. Unlike Mann and Wu, I was never much of an organizer or agitator, which was one reason, Mann would say later, that the committees above decided I would be a mole. He used the English word, which we had learned not so long ago in our English course, taught by a professor whose greatest joy was diagramming sentences. "A mole," I said, "the animal that digs underground?" "The other kind of mole." "There's another kind?" "Of course. To think of a mole as that which digs underground misunderstands the meaning of the mole as a spy. A spy's task is not to hide himself where no one can see him, since he will not be able to see anything himself. A spy's task is to hide where everyone can see him and where he can see everything. Now ask yourself, what can everyone see about you, but you yourself cannot?" "Enough with the riddles," I said. "I give up." "There," he pointed at the middle of my face. "In plain sight." I went to the mirror to see for myself, man peering over my shoulder. There it indeed was, such a part of myself I had long ago ceased to notice it. "Keep in mind that you will not just be any mole," man said, "but the mole that is the beauty spot on the nose of power itself." Man had the natural ability to make the role of a mole or other potentially dangerous task seem attractive. Who would not want to be a beauty spot? I kept that in mind when I consulted my English dictionary, where I discovered that a mole could also be a kind of pier or harbor, a unit of measurement in chemistry, an abnormal mass of uterine tissue, and, if pronounced differently, a highly spiced Mexican sauce of peppers and chocolate that I would one day try and very much enjoy. But what caught my eye and has stayed with me ever since was the accompanying illustration, which depicted not a beauty spot, but the animal, a subterranean, worm-eating mammal with massive clawed feet, a tubular, whiskered snout, and pinhole eyes. It was surely ugly to all except its own mother, and nearly blind. Crushing victims in its path, the movie rolled on with the momentum of a panzer division toward the climactic firefight at King Kong's lair, which would be followed by said lair's incendiary vaporization by the U.S. Air Force. Several weeks of shooting were required for what amounted to 15 minutes of screen time, popping with helicopters, rocket fire, gun battles, and the utter and magnificent destruction of the elaborate sets that had been raised with every intention of being brought low. Enormous supplies of canned smoke ensured that bewildering mists draped the set every so often. While so many blank rounds were fired and such significant quantities of detonation cord and explosives used, that all the birds and beasts of the locality vanished in fear, and the crew walked around with wicks of cotton in their ears. Of course, it was not enough to merely destroy the hamlet and the cave where King Kong hid. To satisfy the auteur's need for realistic bloodshed, all the extras also had to be killed off, as the script called for the deaths of several hundred Viet Cong and Laotians. While there were only 100 extras, most died more than once, many 4 or 5 times. The demand for extras was reduced only after the pièce de résistance of the firefight, an awesome napalm strike delivered by a pair of low-flying F-5s flown by the Philippine Air Force. Most of the enemy thus exterminated, all that was required for the shoot's last days were 20 extras, a reduced population that left the hamlet a ghost town. It was here that the living went to sleep, but the undead awoke. As for three dawns, the set rang to the cry, "Dead enemies, take your places." An obedient tribe of zombies rose from the earth, a score of dismembered dead men stumbling forth from the makeup tent, all bruised and bloody, clothing ripped and torn. Some leaned on comrades and hobbled on only one leg, the other leg strapped up to their thigh. In a free hand they carried a fake limb, the white bone protruding, which they positioned somewhere close once they lay down. Others, with an arm inside a shirt and a sleeve hanging empty, carried a fake mangled arm, while a few cupped the brains falling out of their heads. Some gingerly clutched their exposed intestines, which looked for all the world like glistening strings of white, uncooked sausages, because that was what they were. The use of sausages was an inspired move, for at the appropriate moment when the shooting started, Harry would unleash a stray hound, who would dash hungrily onto the scene and begin gnawing madly at the innards of the dead. These corpses were all that remained of the enemy in the smoldering remains of King Kong's lair, scattered about in grotesque poses where they had fallen after being shot, stabbed, beaten, or choked to death in the bitter hand-to-hand melee between the Viet Cong and the Green Berets, along with their popular forces. The dead included numerous unfortunate, anonymous popular force troops, as well as the four Viet Cong who had tortured Bin and raped Mai, their end dealt to them with appropriate vengeance by Seamus and Bellamy, wielding their K-bar knives with Homeric frenzy until they stood panting in a battlefield, from which arose only the hiss of embers.
Seamus. You hear that?
Bellamy.
I don't hear anything.
Seamus.
Exactly. It's the sound of peace. If only.
The movie was not yet complete. An old woman dashed from the cave to fall, wailing onto the body of her dead VC son. The astonished Green Berets recognized her as the friendly, black-toothed madam of the dismal brothel where they had so often played the venereal disease lottery.
Bellamy. Christ! Mama-san's VC.
Seamus. They all are, kid. They all are.
What do we do with her?
Nothing. Let's go home.
Seamus forgot the cardinal rule of westerns, detective stories, and war movies. Never turn your back on an enemy or a wronged woman. When they did, the enraged Mama-san seized her son's AK-47, blasted Seamus from hip to shoulder blades, then fell victim herself to Bellamy, who, spinning quickly, unloaded the last of his magazine. So she died in slow motion, bathed with 14 lifelike squirts of blood from squibs rigged by Harry, who provided her with two more to bite on.
"This tastes awful," she said afterward, mouth and chin covered in the fake blood I was wiping off.
"Was I convincing?"
"Astonishing," I said, to her great satisfaction. "No one dies like you. Except, of course, for the thespian. To ensure that no one could claim that Asia Sue or James Yoon had outacted him, he demanded that his death be filmed 18 times. The greater acting job was required of the idol, however, who had to embrace the dying Will Seamus in his arms,
a difficult task as the thespian had still not taken a shower after 7 months of shooting.
This was despite the fact that no soldier ever passed up the opportunity for a shower or a bath, even if it amounted to no more than lathering himself with soap and cold water from a helmet. I mentioned this to the thespian one night early in the shooting, and he responded with one of those looks of pity and amusement I was by now so used to getting, the kind that implied not only that my fly was undone, but that there was nothing to see even if it was. "It is exactly because no soldier has done this that I am," he declared. "As a result, no one could force themselves to eat at his table or stand nearer than 15 or 20 feet. His stink so ghastly it drew tears to the idol's face as he leaned in close with every take, weeping and gagging, to hear Seamus whisper his last words. "The whore. The whore." With Seamus dead, the stage was set for Bellamy to call for the arc light strike on King Kong's lair. In the heavens above, an unseen B-52 strato-fortress would squeeze out 30,000 pounds of dumb bombs onto the lair.
the purpose being not to kill the living, but to cleanse the land of the dead, to do a victory dance on King Kong's corpse, to wipe the hippie smile from Mother Earth's face, and to say to the world, "We can't help it. We're Americans." The scene was a massive industrial production that required the digging of several trenches, which were then filled with 2,000 gallons of gasoline, as well as 1,000 smoke bombs, several hundred sticks of phosphorus, a few dozen sticks of dynamite, and untold numbers of rockets, flares, and tracers, all deployed to simulate the explosions coming from King Kong's detonating ammunition stockpile, supplied by the Chinese and the Soviets. Everyone on the crew had been waiting for this moment, the greatest blow-up ever in cinematic history. "It is the moment," the auteur proclaimed to the mass crew during the last week, "when we show that making this movie was going to war itself. When your grandchildren ask you what you did during the war, you can say, 'I made this movie. I made a great work of art.' And how do you know you've made a great work of art? A great work of art is something as real as reality itself, and sometimes even more real than real. Long after this war is forgotten, when its existence is a paragraph and a schoolbook students won't even bother to read, and everyone who survived it is dead, their bodies dust, their memories atoms, their emotions no longer in motion, this work of art will still shine so brightly it will not just be about the war, but it will be the war." And there you have the absurdity. Not that there was not some truth to what the auteur claimed, for the absurd often has its seed in a truth. Yes, art eventually survives war, its artifacts still towering long after the diurnal rhythms of nature have ground the bodies of millions of warriors to powder. But I had no doubt that in the auteur's egomaniacal imagination, he meant that his work of art now was more important than the 3 or 4 or 6 million dead who composed the real meaning of the war. They cannot represent themselves, they must be represented. Marx spoke of the oppressed class that was not politically conscious enough to see itself as a class. But was anything ever more true of the dead, as well as the extras? Their fate was so inane that they drank away their dollar a day every night, an act in which I gladly joined them, feeling a small part of myself dying with them too. For I had an encroaching sense of the meanness of my accomplishment, that I had been deluded into thinking I could affect change in how we were represented. I had altered the script here and there, and incited the creation of a few speaking parts, but to what end? I had not derailed this behemoth or changed its direction. I had only made its path smoother as the technical consultant in charge of authenticity, the spirit haunting bad movies that aspire to be good ones. My task was to ensure that the people scuttling in the background of the film would be real Vietnamese people, saying real Vietnamese things and dressed in real Vietnamese clothing, right before they died. The swing of a dialect and the trim of a costume had to be real, but the truly important things in such a movie, like emotions or ideas, could be fake. I was no more than the garment worker who made sure the stitching was correct in an outfit designed, produced, and consumed by the wealthy white people of the world. They owned the means of production, and therefore the means of representation. And the best that we could ever hope for was to get a word in edgewise before our anonymous deaths. The movie was just a sequel to our war, and a prequel to the next one that America was destined to wage. Killing the extras was either a reenactment of what had happened to us natives, or a dress rehearsal for the next such episode, with the movie the local anesthetic applied to the American mind, preparing it for any minor irritation before or after such a deed. Ultimately, the technology used to actually obliterate natives came from the military-industrial complex, of which Hollywood was a part, doing its dutiful role in the artificial obliteration of natives. I realized this eventually, on the day the final spectacle was supposed to be shot, when, at the last minute, the auteur decided to improvise with the plentiful quantities of leftover gasoline and explosives. The day before, unbeknownst to me, the special effects wizards had received the auteur's instructions, rig the cemetery for destruction. This cemetery had been spared in the original script when King Kong attacked the hamlet, but now the auteur wanted one more scene illustrating the true depravity of both sides. In this scene, a squad of suicidal guerrillas defilated amid the bombs, whereon Seamus would call down a white phosphorus strike on the sacred realm of the hamlet's ancestors, obliterating living and dead with 155-millimeter shells. I learned of this new scene the morning of its shooting, when the arc-like strike was originally scheduled. "Nope," Harry said. "The special effects guys finished prepping the cemetery last night." "I love that cemetery. It's the greatest thing you built." "You got 30 minutes to take a picture before Boom Boom time." It was only a fake cemetery with its fake tomb for my mother, but the eradication of this creation, in its wantonness and its whimsy, hurt me with unexpected severity. I had to pay my last respects to my mother in the cemetery. But I was alone in such sentiments. The cemetery was abandoned, the crew still having breakfast. Among the tombs now ran a maze of yellow trenches gleaming with gasoline, while bundled to the backs of the headstones were sticks of dynamite and phosphorus. Clusters of smoke bombs were staked to the ground, hidden from camera view by headstones and the knee-high grass that had tickled my bare ankles and shins. With my camera slung around my neck, I passed the names of the dead that Harry had written on the tombstones, copied from the Los Angeles phone book and attached to people presumably still alive. Among these names of the living in this little plaza of the past, my mother's name was the only one that genuinely belonged. It was at her headstone I knelt down to say goodbye. The desecration by weather over the past 7 months had eroded much of her face in the photographic reproduction, while the red paint with which her name was written had faded to the hue of dried blood on a sidewalk. Melancholy slipped her dry, papery hand into mine, as she always did when I thought about my mother, whose life was so short, whose opportunities were so few, whose sacrifices were so great, and who was due to suffer one last indignity for the sake of entertainment. "Mama," I said, my forehead on her headstone. "Mama, I miss you so much." I heard the disembodied voice of the crapulent major chuckling. Was it just my imagination, or did all the ambient noise of nature cease? In the preternatural calm of my seance with my mother, I thought I might have been successful in communing with her soul. But just when my mother might have whispered something to me, a giant clap of noise ripped the hearing from my ears. At the same time, a slap in the face lifted me from my knees and hurled me through a blister of light, knocking me out of focus, one self flying while another watched. Later it would be claimed that it was all an accident, the result of a faulty blasting cap that triggered the first explosion, although by then I had decided that it was no accident at all. Only one man could have been responsible for what happened on the set, the man who was so meticulous about every detail that he planned the weekly menu, the auteur. But at the time of the conflagration, my calm self believed God himself had struck my blasphemous soul. Through these eyes of my calm self, I saw my hysterical, screaming self spread his arms and flail them about like a flightless bird. A great sheet of flame shot up before him, while a wave of heat swept over him with such intensity, both he and I lost any sense of feeling. An immense python of helplessness wrapped its smothering grip around us, squeezing us back together into one self with such force I nearly blacked out until my back hit the earth. The meat of my body was now salted, broiled, and tenderized, the world around me afire and stinking of the gasoline sweat emanating from the woolly beast of black smoke lunging and lurching toward me with ever-mutating faces. Another giant clap tore away the silence clogging my ears as I stumbled to my feet. Meteoric chunks of earth and rock whizzed by, and I flung one arm over my head and pulled my shirt over my nose and mouth. There was a narrow path through the fire and smoke, and with my eyes blinded by tears and stinging with soot, I ran, yet again, for my life. The shock wave of another explosion slapped my back. An entire tombstone sailed overhead. A smoke grenade tumbled across the path, and a gray cloud blindfolded me. I found my way by avoiding the heat, coughing and wheezing until I reached open air. Still blind, I kept running, hands waving, gasping in oxygen, feeling the sensation a coward always wants to feel and never wants to feel, that he was alive. It was a feeling possible only after surviving a round of Russian roulette with the gambler who never loses, death. As I was about to thank the God I did not believe in, because, yes, ultimately, I was a coward, a blare of trumpets deafened me. In the silence, the earth vanished, the glue of gravity dissolved, and I was propelled skyward, the wreckage of the cemetery blazing before me, receding as I was blown backwards, the world passing by in a blurred haze that faded into mute darkness. That haze was my life flashing before my eyes, only it unreeled so fast I could not see much of it. What I could see was myself, but what was strange was that my life unreeled in reverse, as in those film sequences where someone who has fallen out of a building and gone splat on the sidewalk suddenly leaps up into the air and flies back through the window. So it was with me, running madly backward against an impressionistic background of blotches of color. I gradually shrank in size until I was a teenager, then a child, and then at last a baby, crawling, until inevitably I was sucked naked and screaming through that portal every man's mother possesses, into a black hole where all light vanished. As the last glimmer faded, it occurred to me that the light at the end of the tunnel seen by people who have died and come back to life was not heaven. Wasn't it much more plausible that what they saw was not what lay ahead of them, but what lay behind? This was the universal memory of the first tunnel we all passed through, the light at its end penetrating our fetal darkness, disturbing our closed eyelids, beckoning us towards the chute that will deliver us to our inevitable appointment with death. I opened my mouth to scream, and then I opened my eyes. I was in a bed shielded by a white curtain, pressed beneath a white sheet. Beyond the curtain came ethereal voices, the ice cube clink of metal, the somersaulting of wheels on linoleum, the maddening squeak of rubber soles, the pitiful beeping of lonely electronic machines. I was dressed in a flimsy crepe gown, but despite the lightness of this and the sheet, a soporific heaviness pressed down on me, scratchy as an army blanket, oppressive as unwanted love. A man in a white coat stood at the foot of my bed, reading a chart on a clipboard with the intensity of a dyslexic. He had the wild, neglected hair of a graduate student in astrophysics. His protuberant belly spilled over the dam of his belt, and he was mumbling into a tape recorder. Patient admitted yesterday, suffering from first-degree burns, smoke inhalation, bruises, concussion. He is... At this point, he noticed me staring at him. "Ah, hello, good morning," said he. "Can you hear me, young man?" "Nod your head." "Very good. Can you say something?" "No." "Nothing's wrong with your vocal cords or your tongue." "Still in shock, I'd say." "Remember your name?" I nodded. "Good. Know where you are?" I shook my head. "A hospital in Manila. The best money can buy. In this hospital, all the doctors not only have MDs, we also have PhDs. That means we are all Philippine doctors. The MD stands for Manila doctors." "Ha! Just joking, my sallow young friend. Of course the MD stands for a medical doctorate, and the PhD stands for a philosophy doctorate, which means I can analyze both what I can see and what I cannot see. Everything physical about you is in relatively good shape, given your recent scare. Some damage, yes, but not bad, considering you should be dead or seriously maimed, a broken arm or a leg at least. In short, you are remarkably lucky. That being said, I suspect you have a headache of Zsa-Zsa Gabor's va-va-va-voom proportions. I recommend anything but psychoanalysis. What I would recommend is a nurse, but we've exported all the pretty ones to America. Any questions?" I struggled to speak, but nothing came out, so I only shook my head. "Rest, then. Remember that the best medical treatment is a sense of relativism. No matter how badly you might feel, take comfort in knowing there's someone who feels much worse." With that, he slipped through the curtain, and I was alone. Above me, the ceiling was white, my sheets white, my hospital gown white. I must be fine if everything was all white, but I was not. I hated white rooms,
and now I was alone in one with nothing to distract me. I could live without television, but not without books. Not even a magazine or a fellow patient alleviated the solitude. And as the seconds, minutes, and hours dribbled away like saliva from a mental patient's mouth, a deep unease descended on me. The claustrophobic sense that the past was beginning to emerge from these blank walls. I was saved from any such visitations by the arrival later that afternoon of the four extras who played the Viet Cong torturers. Freshly shaven and in jeans and t-shirts, they did not look like torturers or villains, but harmless refugees, slightly befuddled and out of place. They bore, of all things, a cellophane-wrapped fruit basket and a bottle of Johnny Walker. "How you doing, Chief?" the shortest extra said. "You look like hell." "All right," I croaked. "Nothing serious. You shouldn't have." "The gifts aren't from us," the tall sergeant said. "The director sent them." "That's nice of him." The tall sergeant and Shorty exchanged a look. "If you say so," Shorty said. "What's that mean?" The tall sergeant sighed. "I didn't want to get into it this early, Captain. Look, have a drink first. The least you can do is drink the man's booze." "I wouldn't mind some," said Shorty. "Pour everyone a drink," I said. "What do you mean, the least I can do?" The tall sergeant insisted I have my drink first, and that warm, sweet glow of affordable blended scotch really did help, as comforting as a homely wife who understands her man's every need. "The word is that what happened yesterday was an accident," he said. "But it's a hell of a coincidence, isn't it? You get in a fight with the director. Yeah, everybody's heard about it. And then you, of all people, get blown up. I don't have any proof. It's just a hell of a coincidence." I was silent as he poured me another. I looked at Shorty. "What do you think?" "I wouldn't put anything past the Americans. They weren't afraid of taking out our president, were they? What's to make you think they wouldn't go after you?" I laughed, even though inside me the little dog of my soul was sitting at attention, nose and ears turned to the wind. "You guys are paranoid," I said. "Every paranoid person is right at least once," said the tall sergeant, "when he dies." "Believe it or don't," said Shorty. "But look, the reason we all came here wasn't just to talk about this. We all wanted to say thanks, Captain, for all the work you did during this whole shoot. You did a swell job taking care of us, getting us extra pay, talking back to the director." "So let's drink that bastard's liquor in your honor, Captain," said the tall sergeant. My eyes welled up with tears as they raised their glasses to me, a fellow Vietnamese who was, despite everything, like them. My need for validation and inclusion surprised me, but the trauma of the explosion must have weakened me. Man had already warned me that for the kind of subterranean work we did, there would be no medals or promotions or parades. Having resigned myself to those conditions, the praise of these refugees was unexpected. I comforted myself with the memory of their words after they left, as well as with Johnny Walker, forgoing my glass and drinking straight from the bottle. But after the bottle was empty sometime that night, I was finally left with nothing but myself and my thoughts, devious cab drivers that took me where I did not want to go. Now that my room was dark, all I could see was the only other all-white room I had been in at the National Interrogation Center back in Saigon, working my first assignment under Claude's supervision. In that instance, I was not the patient. The patient, whom I should properly call the prisoner, had a face I could remember very clearly. So often had I studied him via the cameras mounted in the corners of his room. Every inch of it had been painted white, including his bed frame, his desk, his chair, and his bucket, the only other occupant. Even the trays and the plates with his food and the cup for his water and his bar of soap were white. And he was only allowed to wear a white T-shirt and white boxer shorts. Besides the door, the only other opening was for sewage, a little dark hole in the corner. I was there when the workmen built the room and painted it. The idea for the all-white room was Claude's, as was the use of air conditioners to keep the room at 18 degrees Celsius, cool even by Western standards, and freezing for the prisoner. "This is an experiment," Claude said, "to see whether a prisoner will soften up under certain conditions. These conditions included overhead fluorescents that were never turned off. They provided his only light, the timelessness matching the spacelessness induced by the overwhelming whiteness.
White painted speakers were the final touch, mounted on the wall and ready to broadcast at every minute of the day. "What should we play?" Claude asked. "It has to be something he can't stand." He looked at me expectantly, ready to grade me.